everybody. It's time for Mac Break Weekly. We've got a special guest because I am filling in for Leo. John Voorhees from MacStories.net is here. We have so much to talk about. We're going to talk about AI. Yeah, sure. We're going to talk about the European Union. We're going to reconvene our MacBook Air Club because there's a bunch of new MacBook Air news and a whole lot more, including our picks. It's all coming up next on Mac Break Weekly.
This episode is brought to you by Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are now using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero trust AI.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 913 for March 19th, 2024. I don't go out very often.
This episode of Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Wix Studio. I only have a minute to tell you about Wix Studio. It's the web platform for agencies and enterprises. Let me just, you know, see if I can do this in 60 seconds. Just a few things you can do from start to finish in a minute or less on Studio. You can adapt your designs for every device with responsive AI. You can expand Wix Studio's pre-made solutions with back-end and front-end APIs. You could generate code and troubleshoot bugs with a built-in AI code assistant. You could switch up the styling of hundreds of web pages. I mean, fonts, layouts, colors, everything, all with one click. You can add no-code animations. You can add gradient backgrounds. You can do that right in the editor. You could start a design library. You could package your code and UI in reusable full-stack apps. Oh, one more thing. You can deliver everything your client needs in one smooth handover. Whew, time's up. But the list keeps going. Really, you got to check it out. Step into Wix Studio and see for yourself. Go to wix.com/studio or click on the link on the show page to find out more. Wix. Wow.
Welcome back, everybody, to Mac Break Weekly. Again, Leo is on assignment and his assignment was a vacation. So I am Jason Snell and I normally am not the host, but I'm just one of the guests. But now I'm the host. And then we have a whole little trickle down system where then other people become guests. And it's like, you know how podcasts work. Anyway, let me introduce my panel today. Two usual faces back again. The family is here. Andy Inatko joins us as always. Hi, Andy.
Can I say what a pleasure it is, as always, to be trickled down from you, Jason?
You may not. And Alex Lindsay is also here.
Good to be on the trickle.
It is. We're all done. Now that we have formed our little nuclear Mac Break family, even though Papa Leo is not here, let's introduce the interloper, the guest, the visitor. We'll make him feel at home because we're nice to our guests here at Mac Break Weekly. From MacStories.net, it's John Voorhees. Hi, John.
Hello. Good to be here. I don't know how I feel about being at the bottom of the trickle, but, you know, I guess I'll take it.
You're in a different stream or something. I don't know what's happening.
We're Leo, all splashing in the same glorious puddle, look, everybody.
Leo leaves and everything is different. So, Mac Break Weekly, of course, we talk about Apple stuff. That's the podcast. We've done 913 episodes at this count of this thing, so you should know, hopefully, how it works by now. Let's start with a conversation about AI. You know, when Steven Spielberg took that movie over after Stanley Kubrick died, not that one, the actual one. Apple, big. Yes, Andy Inatko. This is all about you, Andy. Surprise, this episode. No.
It usually is. If it isn't, I usually make it about me. That's what listeners love.
Big Mark Gurman scoop this week, which I think, thumbs up to Mark for doing this. Apple talking to Google about licensing Gemini for use in iOS 18 for generative AI. And I think I'm very interested in what all of you have to think about this. I took a journey, like as I read it, I sort of took a journey that started with, oh, Apple is desperate because they're behind, and ended with, actually, does Apple need to build its own LLM, or is it better off using a partner for that sort of thing. And I'm curious what all of you think about this this news that Apple and Google are talking again. It's just a report from Mark that they're talking about Google's Gemini being the backing for some of Apple's AI features in iOS 18.
I think that in some cases that same, you know, in the same way that we use Google search, there is also, in addition to Google's doing a lot more work and probably ahead of Apple, there's also the case of, we tell you it's by Gemini or by Google, and if something goes wrong, it's Google's fault, not Apple's fault. Because I think that Apple's self-correction process makes it really hard for AI to work, because they have a very high threshold for needing, very low threshold for risk, or yep. They just really right. don't want to have it telling somebody to do something that's horrible, having a third party tell them to do it on the platform when it's generally a trusted friend. And if it happens, well, Google needs to work on that a little bit more so than if Apple did it themselves. I think that self-correction process that Apple has is really going to hold them back. And I think we see that with Siri all the time, Now, I do think that the other thing to look at is there's been rumors that they've talked about with OpenAI as well. It's not necessarily all or one either. They could build, other companies are building federated solutions that are, going and getting your answer from a lot of different sources and then bringing those back together to give you something that might be more accurate or at least less inaccurate that's there. So I think that they could be using all of the above as well as just working with Google. And I do think that there's the rumors that are connected to also that Apple could be building something into the iPhone 16 that does a lot of the work on site. So I think that there's a whole lot of, there's a gray area here. It doesn't sound like it's a black and white thing, and it's still a rumor, so it's all gray. But I think that there's a gradient here where Apple does everything on the computer to Google does everything.
Yeah. No, it's just that Apple has a huge problem. Like, if they really do want to compete with anybody in AI, if they really want to take advantage of what everybody wants AI to provide, the best step for them to do next is to have 10 years ago started investing $1 billion a year in artificial intelligence. And unfortunately, we don't have any rumors about a flux capacitor having been a part of the Apple Car project, so they can't go back in time. So they have to hook up and get the technology of people who have been working that way. And Google really is nearly at the top of the tree, or joining the top of the tree with a couple of the people here. 10 years ago, when Apple was gung-ho on VR and gung-ho on the Apple Car, Google was... Sundar Pichai was at keynote saying, we are kind of redefining the company as we are an AI-based company, just as in 2006, we had to reorganize all of our strategies based on mobile computing. Today, we're reorganizing our future strategies based on AI. And this isn't something that Apple can do something very, very simple, very quickly, but they need to do something more than autocomplete, auto summarize, auto transcribe. And the problem with that is that it's not just a case of getting the right brain power and getting the right code together. They also need a hell of a lot of infrastructure to do that. OpenAI can rely on a partnership with Microsoft. So they have Microsoft Azure cloud computing servers. Google has its own huge network of computing servers to build and to run its LLMs, the ones that don't run on the device. Apple would not be able to build that out in any quick piece of time. And the third problem is that I was in the same boat as you, Jason. Like, as I'm reading this, I was in bed in the morning, sort of, hey, I'm not really working yet, I'm just going to scroll through some stuff to see what I'm going to be doing, and started like taking notes on thoughts. And one of the first ones was like, I kept thinking about every single sitcom in which the manager makes a pitch to the vice president about hey, there's the pitch they're going to make to the company. Hey, here's the big idea we've got for the next ad campaign, or here's what we're going to do for the product rollout. And they've been working on this idea for like months and months and months, and they know they got gold here. And the VP says, that's not really what you're going to present to the CEO. And they say, no, that wasn't the idea. No, we have the real idea is 10 times better than that. And in a month's time, when we present to the CEO, I feel as though like Tim Cook is like, virtual reality was the thing that they thought they're going to make all their investors and their board and everybody happy with. So, oh no, AI was going to be the big thing that we're going to be rolling out. And trust me, when you see WWDC, we'll have so many announcements, and they need to have a portfolio and a plan in place. So I agree with Alex that it's not necessarily, hey, we're going to, it doesn't sound like an Apple thing to say, we are going to hand off the entire AI part of all of our phone features and all of our desktop features and all of our whatever features to another company. It's enough to have a partnership. Google and Apple have worked very well in partnership before. They are very simpatico in so many ways. But if all they do is come up with something that will get them through the next year to make everybody kind of relax a little bit and think that, no, we haven't totally forgotten about this. No, we're not just doing AI as a way to touch up your photos automatically. We are going to be the company that the next time you get an iPhone, it will be able to screen your calls for you. Our photo editor will be able to do sophisticated erasings and edits. We will be able to take your inbox from Apple Mail and answer a query like, show me all of the work emails that seem to be very, very urgent from the past week and correctly summarize that. That's the sort of stuff they're going to have to deliver to compete, and that's the sort of stuff that they're going to need a partnership with someone like with Google and Gemini in order to pull that off.
John, what do you think about this one?
Yeah, I think on balance, I think it is a good idea. I mean, my first reaction was this just isn't going to end well because, you know, Gemini has had some issues in terms of hallucinations and lack of guardrails. And I think if there are conversations going on with Apple, I got to imagine that those guardrails are going to be right at the forefront, because even if they are able to, you know, use Google Gemini as the back end for their AI technology and therefore be able to maybe blame any problems on Google, it's still a bad look if that happens on Apple's watch. I do think, you know, and I'm not 100% convinced that just because Apple doesn't talk about AI a lot that they haven't been working on it. Now, I do kind of share your thought, Andy, that they are behind compared to other companies for sure. But I know that I think they're working on it, but I think the Google thing is a good way to go because they do need the infrastructure. And I don't believe they probably have that. And having a company like Google that already has that built out is going to allow them to take things that can't be done on device and push them out to the cloud to get the answer. And I think that that's a big part of what we're seeing here, is that the iPhone and the technology in it is getting very close to the point where a lot of AI functionality can be brought onto the device. That's certainly being done on some of the newer Macs. It's also being done on the iPhone. It can be done on the iPhone to a degree, but I don't think it's quite there to really do it fully on the devices. And I think that that is a really good reason to bring on a partner like Google. And at the end of the day, I think this may be kind of like an Apple Maps situation where, you know, Apple relied on Google Maps for years for the Maps app. And then when they were ready, they actually got pushed a little early, I guess, into their own map data, but they moved on and they did their own. And I kind of expect that that's where we'll see this go, maybe 3 to 5 years down the road.
It does feel like this is part of a nutritious breakfast, right? Like it's a, I would not be surprised if in the end, Apple's got a model that maybe runs on your phone and it does a bunch of different stuff, right? And it's been trained to talk to your apps and talk to services that Apple runs and talk to other cloud services. We've talked a lot about, you know, Shortcuts has helped build this whole intense model for apps. Like theoretically, a model on your phone could talk to your apps and without, you know, and look up information and do stuff on your phone. And then one thing that a model on your phone could do is talk to a large language model that's in the cloud. And that would actually, John talked about guardrails. That was one of the things that struck me, is one way Apple can put its own stamp on some output from an LLM is to have its own model that knows how to use that LLM and knows how to discard things and summarize things, right, and check things. And so it's sort of like, I have no doubt that Apple is going to have like a single product. It may even be just Siri AI, something like that. But I just keep thinking, the right way to think about this is not like, oh, Apple's given up and Google's just going to do its AI for it. I think it's more like, right, Apple needs a partner who has this enormous investment in infrastructure, because every iPhone user is going to start using this. Who could even do that? It's a very small number of companies, and Apple's not going to just turn it loose. It's going to be for a limited number of queries that are probably controlled by a model that Apple runs that chooses when to talk to it. And I don't know that when I started to think about it like that, I was like, okay, they might even have multiple partners, right? They might even take certain queries and give them to OpenAI and other queries to Google? We don't know, because this is a very specific report about Gemini. So it sounds to me, when I think about it that way, I'm like, okay, so it's basically it's Apple being Apple, right? They're going to build this kind of like user layer up top, and then they've got a partnership to go out, and they can replace it at the drop of a hat with their own or with a different partner. And they can't do it today, so they have to find a partner.
And you could, in a federated environment, there could be a couple different layers, as you said, that can be done there, where Apple interrogates all of the information on your phone as with its own LLM. Because there's a lot of times where you're searching for that email with the thing, an email with a picture that someone sent you 6 months ago that now you need. And you could say, hey, I had an email from this client, and they sent me a photo, and it kind of looked like this. Or, you know, kind of had this, and this. Can you find that for me? And it just pops up, you know, like it just, so yeah. it's not right. Personal information. It's also information that you might have lots of, you might put a bunch of documents in. One of the things that, that has been really useful that I'm not using as much, but I have friends that are using a lot, is putting a bunch of documents into an LLM and then being able to just ask real world questions of those documents. And it just comes back and synthesizes that for you. And so, and sometimes those documents, when I say documents, that's like sometimes 40 books. Like take all the text from 40 books, throw them in there. Now I'm just going to ask questions of that book, and I'm going to get all those answers with references of where those came from. And that's, from a study perspective, that's incredibly powerful. And that can all be done on the phone. But then you can go, I need a question about, like, how would Richard Feynman explain momentum to a fifth grader? So that's a Gemini question or a ChatGPT question that's going to handle. It's not signing the phone. It's kind of making something up. Or I need an image, and it's going to go out to, maybe it goes out to Midjourney. And in those search cases, what Apple can do for the user is anonymize it. So they can put it, they can give it a hash. And a different hash every single time, make the request, have it come back. So you have anonymized searches going into the AI, coming back, getting the outside information from the outside providers, whether it's imagery or 3D models or text or video or whatever it is, and keeping it away from the user, or keeping the user's identifying factors away from the service. But then being able to interrogate data on the phone or things that are known that Apple can dump into it. If you look at stability's got a lot already in it. So, you know, Apple could put a 12 gig file into a new iPhone 16 that's got, you know, a ton of whatever, and do a lot of answers on its own in a really stable way.
Yeah.
Right. And then interrogate your own stuff, but then protect your privacy again as you interact with all these exterior connections.
Yeah. I mean, I feel as though AI could be to Apple what multi-touch was to BlackBerry. Like AI, if Apple doesn't embrace AI, figure out a way to embed it, to basically improve all their platforms with it in the ways that are logical for it to be improved. This is the first time I've ever seen a real weakness, potential weakness in the iPhone. That if, because last time I bought a flagship phone, meaning spending more than $1,000 on a phone, like it really was between, it was 2 years ago, 2 or 3 years ago, it was between the Pixel 6 and the iPhone 13 Pro. And Google made a pitch about, we're basically making this as an AI phone. We've got tensor processors that are designed specifically to run smaller versions of our AI models. Here are a whole bunch of features that are unique to this phone that are empowered by these AI models. The features themselves really intrigue me, and they've proven extremely useful. And Apple is starting to catch up kind of right now. And the idea of this as a future roadmap also intrigued me. And at this point, it really is the sort of thing where it's the basic table stakes for a flagship phone at this point. And if Apple doesn't manage to get that sort of empowerment inside these devices, also inside all of their desktop offerings, it would feel as though it would feel like this is BlackBerry suddenly deciding to slap a multi-touch screen on top of an interface that they've never really considered multi-touch to begin with. And this is the way that Apple could get their lunch eaten.
I just don't agree with that, though. I think that Apple has been using AI in lots of ways. And I think that the way you're phrasing that sort of simplifies it down to Apple didn't pay attention to AI and now they suddenly are trying to catch up.
No,
and
that's not what I meant. No,
they've had AI features for ages and they continue to. There is actually some very rare for Apple proof that is above the waterline that we can see about what Apple's doing. Right. They put out a paper about how they're doing their podcast transcripts, which involves some technical stuff about finding a word error rate for AI generated transcripts by comparing them to human transcriptions and comparing them and trying to come up with a fundamental like quality rating for their transcripts. There was a big post that they posted to Archive about MM1 methods, analysis, and insights from multimodal LLM pre-training, where they seem, based on the comments from people who are in this business, to have broken some interesting ground on training and pre-training these large language models. So like they have and they also keep buying startups. They bought a new AI startup this time, and this goes back years. I think that Apple Podcast Transcripts feature has its roots in a 2017 acquisition. So I think where they got caught flat-footed was on the rapid growth of LLMs in public that happened over the last couple of years. And so that one fits a little bit better, I think, to me.
That's just to clarify that that's definitely true. And the signs of Apple's investment in AI have been present. Really, their biggest push has been through computational photography and basically trying to figure out what is in this picture, what needs to be enhanced where and how in order to make this look as good as possible. But there's a difference in scale between what OpenAI is doing, what Google is doing, what a couple other companies are doing, and the sort of stuff we've seen from Apple. It's one thing to create a model that can run on a phone and do some very specific things. It's one thing to have research that is well thought of by the research community. It's another thing to say, here is this thing, we're calling it ChatGPT. Here is a website where anybody can go in and try to use it. Here is a service you can pay $20 a month to get additional features for it. Once you let the entire world loose upon this thing, to not just keep them inside a box of easily anticipated loads, power consumption needs, feature needs, all that sort of stuff. Once you get outside of that box, it gets really, really difficult. And that is the place where I'm thinking that they didn't think that they really needed to make that huge investment. I mean, so it's only, remember that it was recently that we're still getting reports of Apple just regularly losing some of their best AI talent to other companies. And the reason why that was happening wasn't because they weren't getting paid enough or because Apple wasn't prestigious enough. It was because that if you don't want to build hypothetical cars, you want to build actual cars that you can then actually drive. And AI researchers want to build LLMs, want to build technologies that are actually going to be turned into real large scale world changing things. And they weren't getting that by and large at Apple. That's going to change from now on. But I'm saying they have been investing, but I don't think they've been doing the sort of stuff that can deliver the features that a lot of other companies can provide today.
There's a real big opportunity here, I think, which is what Jason touched on, which is the app intents, because we've seen devices like the Rabbit that was announced during CES, which goes out and interacts with web apps. The thing about Apple is they can do that, but they can also interact with the apps that are already on your phone. So they've got a wealth of information on an iPhone to do just about anything they want if they can get the right tools there to query it. And I think that Shortcuts, as many bugs and problems as it has had over the years, is built on a foundation of technologies that now permeate throughout the OS. You know, it's Spotlight Search, all kinds of things are driven by this. And if it can be adapted to work with a large language model, I think that it kind of gives Apple a pretty nice boost up in that area, I think.
I think that the large language models are the start. As a pretty heavy Apple user, I don't really feel like anything's missing. I think Apple could take a long time to go down this path before I would really notice, because I'm using ChatGPT, I'm using Midjourney, I'm using other things to do all these things, and I don't necessarily need it to come out of the OS. I've kind of decided that Siri is, not super effective.
Not great.
And so I don't really lean on Siri that often, other than when she keeps on coming up for no reason when someone has two sibilants in their audio. Anyway, but I think that I think that there's also tons of things that Apple could do around, you know, there's, because the privacy is so tight, a lot of things that for anybody else to do would be really creepy, which is they can pay attention to all kinds of things that your phone's doing. Like when you walk around to this place or when you paste, you're probably going to want a coffee soon. Like, you know, you're probably going to go do these things, and AI can sit there and on the phone, make a whole bunch of decisions about, you know, some of the stuff that Apple does now. A little bit of a heads up. Like if I go looking for my QR code at Whole Foods, if I go down and ask for an app, it usually pops up the Amazon app now. Like if I scroll down, because it goes, I know you're at Whole Foods. And every time you stand where you're standing, I know that you're going to ask for that app. And so the thing is that I think that there's a lot of places where it can just make life a little bit easier. But again, I think Apple, probably less than others because it sells hardware, is, you know, it doesn't have to be in a rush. And that's the advantage Apple generally has. They were way behind in VR until they put out a headset, you know, so I think that they can figure this out. I do think that the federated solution that we just talked about, if Apple goes down that path, is actually the best one that we will have seen when they release it this fall, if it happens, because the mixture of highly secure local searches mixed with you know, expansive ones on the web, that mixture I don't think really exists anywhere else. And so I think that there's a lot, they do have an opportunity to still innovate using everybody else's innovations, which is what Apple is pretty good at.
That's the secret sauce, right? Is to take a product level and say, what do users want, right? Because the fact is, nobody is going to say, I want to use an LLM. I mean, they're nerds, right? But like, nobody's like, oh, I want a chatbot. I want to do a Midjourney. What they're going to say, and this is where Apple can add that value and add that Appleness to the layer, is what do you want to do? And based on that task, have a model that runs on your phone that says, I know how to do those things. And one of the tools it uses to do that is somebody else, Google's perhaps large language model, but there are lots of other tools that are part of it. Because I don't think it's realistic to say, oh, I want to use a large language model. It's like, what does the user actually want to do? Right. And if Apple can have an intelligent assistant that lives on top of stuff like someone else's AI system for something like, you know, the things that Gemini is good for, then that lets Apple differentiate the iPhone experience, which quite honestly, that's what they care about, right? It's like, is the iPhone able to do more stuff now? And that buys them time to potentially down the road replace some or all of the white labeled Google large language model with their own thing. But that could be years down the road.
And what Apple's really good at is taking a bunch of technology and putting this nice wrapper on the front where you forget what the technology was. You know, like they don't talk about, I mean, they say that they have Atmos and Vision, but what they really talk about is spatial sound and spatial video and high dynamic range and so, but not even high dynamic range. They just make it better, you know, but the idea is they take all the stuff and they put it into kind of this fuzzy cocoon that you don't have to really look at, but it just makes life a little bit easier. And I think that, and some people complain about that, but I think for the average user, just having it, like the average Apple user, they just want it to work. They just want to do something. They want it to be a little easier. They want it to be a little faster. They don't need it to be the most high tech, crazy thing. If, you know, they need it to be something that just makes life a little bit more convenient or a little bit easier or a little bit more powerful. And I think that incrementally, Apple's really good, probably one of the best in the world at taking something that's complex to understand and make it just simple, that it just happens to do it on its own.
Yeah, it's just that I hope that we see, I think that sooner rather than later, we're going to see features that it's important that people don't realize they're necessarily using an LLM, but I have to launch this web app in order to get this query handled. We want these features to be baked right into the OS and so easy to use that you don't even consider not using them. And there's going to come a day very, very soon where you can do things. There'll be a window on a certain operating system where you can say, hey, take all of the screenshots on my desktop and create file names that describe what's in it. Or find me all of the documents that are related to this case that I've been working on for the past 3 weeks, but leave out X, Y, and Z. And put them in a folder and send it to everybody who I'm working on this project with, and literally say things like that, and things like that actually happen. Those things are very, very achievable right now with a certain amount of human oversight to make sure you're not about to do something, the AI is about to do something stupid. That's the sort of stuff that I think is going to be right on the surface. in the next year or so of both mobile and desktop operating systems. And Apple needs to at least make sure that whatever the fall updates to all their operating systems are, there does seem to be a pathway through that kind of secret sauce. Now, in terms of having like a full scale LLM, in terms of having something like OpenAI or Gemini, even the very, very best in class is still not great. Yeah. I mean, I have subscriptions to like three different chatbots because each one is good at different things. I mean, Gemini is wonderful at copy editing, brainstorming ideas. OpenAI is much better at generating code, this sort of stuff. So Apple definitely has a runway to figure out how they can replicate that kind of technology for their own selves. And again, that's going to require not just software, but it's going to require more real estate, you know, more server farms, more real estate near a good constant power source is going to be even more valuable in the next coming years than they were before. But there are some things that Apple absolutely needs to have that shine in the next year, or else they'll start to really, again, people who are kind of on the fence one way or another, hey, my next phone could be an iPhone, could be an Android phone, my next desktop could be a $2,000 MacBook. It could be a $1,300 HP notebook. But if there's this one demo, or if there's one friend who, and you look over their shoulder and say, how are you doing that? So, that's just built into Windows, or, that's just built into iOS, or, that's just built into Android. That can be the thing that sends people to make a rash decision, contrary to the marketing choice that they've made for the past 10 years of their lives.
Well, if Apple doesn't have in the works a machine learning model that knows how to use Spotlight to search your Mac or iPhone or whatever and give you a good list of results. I mean, they've been tinkering with that, but like, you're right, Andy, that stuff needs to be there, because that's the whole idea is we are entering an era where being an expert computer user who knows exactly where to click on the interface in the right place or tap to get the things and put them all together, that job could be done by a machine learning model, so that you as a person just need to say, this is what I want to get. And you don't need the intermediate step because it's the expert computer user. Nobody is a better computer user than your computer, right? Theoretically. And if the whole future, the whole past of computers is do things for me so I don't have to waste my time. And the fact is, being a great Spotlight jockey and knowing exactly the query to get your Excel files from this time window that contain this word is a nice thing that nerds like us enjoy being able to do. The best thing is if you can just say, can you get me those Excel files from that time period? And the thing does it for you. And that's, I think that's where the big innovation in being, in user interfaces on devices is coming. It's that sort of thing.
Yeah. And I think to what John was pointing out, I think that the ability to do natural language shortcuts will be transformational.
Absolutely.
When I go, like, when I walk into my room, when I walk into this room, I want you to turn the lights on. Right. And that's it. you just say that and it creates a shortcut and it installs and so that it happens.
Right.
Or every day when I get home, I want you to start the teapot.
It's the shortest cut of all, Alex. The shortest cut of all is a shortcut you don't even write.
You go, when I get up tomorrow, like you could literally go to your phone and go, when I wake up tomorrow, I want the coffee to be hot at 6 a.m.
Yeah,
and then
exactly.
Just, and that kind of stuff, and that's all internal. That's all like not crazy GPT stuff to do.
Right, John in our members Discord says, "Does the average Joe really care about AI?" And my response to him was, "No, it's about features. Like in the end, as with anything, an end like without a means, whatever you want to say, an effect without a cause, it's pointless, right? And this is something that Apple has actually historically." And I mean, super historically been very good at is focusing on what people want instead of just picking up a new tech and saying, oh, here's new tech. Can I make a feature out of this? Now, sometimes that gets them in trouble. And I would argue that maybe with the LLMs, it got them in a little bit of trouble because they couldn't see the endpoint until by the time they saw how it could be applied, it was maybe a little bit, it was too late. Right.
Yeah.
But implemented well, the goal is not to say we have an LLM. The goal is to say, oh, we have these new features that do things for you and make your life easier, and you will want to use them because they're WYSI or AI, but because they make your life easier. And that's what everybody's trying to go for. The challenge is that we all saw those LLMs and we all start to think, oh man, this is going to make people's life easier once it's productized in the right way. So,
the end goal of any new feature is to provoke somebody looking over your shoulder to say, how are you doing that? And why doesn't my phone do that?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
So people don't care about LLMs, just like they don't care about TrueType. They don't have to know about what the font system is on the Mac. It just works great. And you makes it easy to put in fonts. It makes it great to scale them up and down. So yeah, I'm very confident that Apple can do that. The one last thing though, there was a lot of beard stroking all across the world yesterday about this sort of stuff. And one of them was that, maybe it's because I locked into the idea of BlackBerry so soon on. So I was thinking of everything that BlackBerry did to respond to the iPhone, where it was, again, just, oh, well, we'll do what we were doing before, but now with multi-touch. And no, you didn't get it. You didn't understand what the whole point of this thing was. And it made me think that, well, is the end 5 years from now, 10 years from now, aren't we hoping that the best outcome for AI on our phone is that we don't even interact with apps at all? It's in a drawer. We can launch an app if we want to, but mostly an AI just simply collects, or we simply express an intent, and an AI simply takes that intent and distributes it amongst whatever apps, codes, infrastructures, whatever it has access to. And so the idea of having patting itself on the back, a company for having AI features on top of their desktop, on top of their mobile operating system, might be just like, hey, look, we slapped a touchscreen on BlackBerry, and now you had an opportunity to reinvent everything and leapfrog over whatever else was doing. Why don't you start on the future today instead of starting on 10 years ago today?
Possible, but I mean, that's what the Humane AI Pen and maybe the Rabbit are trying to do. And I appreciate the leap, but the danger there is you're leaping and you don't get to the other side of the Snake River Canyon because it's too early and you need to start to build to it. Because I think you're right. Like the end goal is to make everything so easy that you only need to use your device when your input is necessary as a human. And we don't always want to drive things by typing or drive things by voice. Sometimes we want it to be more visual. There's going to be some evolution there. Okay, we need to move on. We got a lot more to talk about. We're going to take a break. Leo is going to beam in from his vacation right into the studio in Petaluma, and we will be back after that. Leo?
Hey, Jason, wait a minute. Hold on. Hello. I got to take over here for a bit just to tell you about Collide. Did you hear the news? We talked about Collide for ages. Love Collide, but they just got acquired by 1Password. Wow, huge news, since both companies are leading the industry in creating security solutions that put users first. For over a year now, Collide Device Trust has helped companies with Okta ensure that only known and secured devices can access their data. Well, just to reassure you, that's exactly what they're still doing. They're just doing it now as part of 1Password. So if you have Okta and you've been meaning to check out Collide, don't worry, now's a great time. Collide comes with a library of pre-built device posture checks, and you can write your own custom checks for just about anything you could think of. Plus, I love this, you can use Collide on devices without MDM. That means your Linux fleet, contractor devices, and every BYOD phone and laptop in your company. And now that Collide's part of 1Password, it's only going to get better. Check it out at collide.com/MacBreak to learn more. Watch that demo today. That's KOLIDE.com/MacBreak. Congratulations, Collide. That's really good news. All right, Jason, back to you.
Thank you, Leo. He looked to the right, because that's usually where my picture is in the computer screen. That's hilarious. That's like where I live usually is off to his right. All right, let's talk a little bit. I know people are tired of it. I'm honestly tired of it, but there's more news here and maybe we can find an interesting spin on it. There's some interesting developments in the whole Apple in the EU regulation, Digital Markets Act kind of stuff. There's some new stuff there. There was a compliance workshop, which sounds like something that maybe Torquemada would have been involved with.
I was thinking like an arts and crafts sort of thing where they're gluing googly eyes onto popsicle sticks and pretending, hey, this is my new music library. Oh, look. Hey, look, we can play together.
No one expects the compliance workshop. But anyway, so this is where they there was actually like a session. It was streamed. There were people in the meeting room, including Raleigh Tested, who does AltStore, was in the room wearing a sweatshirt, talking to a bunch of people in suits. I thought that was kind of a fitting thing for computer people talking to the suits in government about what's going on, about the core technology fee, which is Riley's whole point was he released an app when he was a teenager that would have cost like 3 million euros under this regime that Apple is suggesting, where they charge you for every install if you're outside of the app store. So some interesting, I thought, responses from the Apple person. Steve Troughton-Smith posted a video capture of this on Mastodon, the idea that Apple is listening and there was a stay tuned about things like the core technology fee. So it sounds, as we talked about last week, John, you weren't here, but last week we talked a little bit about Apple's new strategy, which is do the minimum and then just keep making changes. Yeah, let's play that exchange with Riley. If we could, can we do that? Maybe not. I can't hear it anyway. A hat and a sweatshirt. It was great. John, what do you think about the compliance workshop that nobody expects?
Right. No, that was surprising. I didn't realize that was going to happen. And I thought Riley's question obviously is a good one. It's spot on, because there are edge cases and Apple has not solved for every edge case. And I think what to me this event showed is that things like the core technology fee are really probably targeted more directly to the big players in the marketplace. You know, when you step way back and look at everything that's going on, the EU is trying to regulate big tech. Those are gatekeepers. And Apple's rules, largely, I think, are targeted at companies like Meta or Spotify or Google or whomever it happens to be. Who's getting squeezed and run over by the bus in the process? It's the little guys, yeah. The ones who aren't, you know, they may in some edge cases fall into the same bucket as Spotify or Meta, but they really weren't necessarily intended to be by Apple. And the trouble is coming up with a kind of a definition that would let those players out, that would allow some kid making a viral app to go, you know, to be free and go viral and not have to pay millions of dollars, to allow that to happen without creating a loophole for the likes of Meta or other big players whose revenues that Apple wants to keep.
And again, it doesn't mean that person couldn't do it. They just couldn't do it outside the app. I mean, the app store.
Right,
so you could distribute something. If you decide to distribute something inside the app, you could download, Apple's point is you could do as many millions as you want. We'll pay for all of that.
Right. Absolutely.
You know, like all those downloads. And so it's not like it leaves that person out in the cold when we say getting squeezed. It just means that you would still pay 15% of people if you're selling it for something.
Riley's app though was an emulator and Apple would not approve it. So it was never going to be in the store. Riley had no alternative but to release it separately. And then got millions of downloads.
And I think that Apple's going to look at what the EU says. I think if you're putting something out that they wouldn't approve and you're going to put it out on the outside, like from Apple's point of view, you have no value to them. Like you may think you have value to them and you have value to your users that might want to buy it. But to Apple, you have zero value. So the thing is that they're going to look for where the EU allows them. Cause I think that their argument is that we do provide some value by having a platform and, you know, we do have, you know, engineering, so on and so forth. This is, you know, something that we made, you know, and we should get some kind of revenue out of that. And so you have a lot of people that are arguing that they shouldn't, but that's Apple's argument. And but I don't think Apple's trying to really fix that. They'll say that they're listening, but what they're really listening for is for the EU to tell them what they're allowed and not allowed to do. They're not really listening to someone who builds an app that was going to break a bunch of rules and then wants to put it on the outside. They don't really care what he says. Just to be blunt, they care about what the EU says about whether they can charge per unit, yeah. But
that's the question: is does the EU care about Riley and other small developers like that,
Spotify,
or do they only care about big companies? Yeah. And I think we're going to find out because this entire core technology fee does affect the big guys too. And I think that there are a lot of other things going on here, including that bar that we talked about last week, where Apple says, oh, you can only really follow the rules after you've already been inside our gates and kept by us in our gates for 2 years and have had big sales. And then you can go,
right.
Which is like, well, wait a second. What are we talking about here? Is that you don't have to be a gatekeeper forever, but you have to be gate kept for a little while and be successful at it. And then you can go out. Like, what is the European Commission trying. John, you work with people in Europe. What's your read on this situation?
I do. I really don't think that anybody has the interests of the little guy at heart here. I mean, I really think that this law was designed to really address the big corporations, the big American technology companies, and at the behest, largely, I think, of Spotify, which is a European tech giant. And I don't think, I mean, as much as Apple provides tools and resources for small developers, I think it's pretty clear over the years that it's Apple first, its customers, including what it views as its customers, which are the people who are buying apps on the App Store, second, and developers, third. And I think that that is, you can see that in Apple's rules, but you can also see it in the DMA's approach and the EU's approach. I think that if Apple can create the room for those little guys to thrive, they will. But I don't think that that's the priority of anybody here, either the EU or Apple itself.
Yeah, yeah. All along, it's been a case of we've all seen Apple trying to weasel out of something that they're being forced to do, but they don't want to do. I don't see what they're doing here as weaseling out. It really is like it really is a case of we have brand new laws. I'm not going to over comply with the law. I'm going to say, I'm going to try to make sure that we find the lowest ground that the regulators are comfortable with. The flip side of this is that we all have to remember that the DMA isn't about, making sure that people who feel as though they've been financially made to endure a hardship by a gatekeeper, by a large company, get some sort of redress. It is a punitive action. It's like if you get drunk and you drive through somebody's fence, like, yes, the person whose fence you destroyed is going to sue you to get the fence back. But no, the cops are there to arrest you because you shouldn't have been drunk and driving through a fence to begin with. So it's definitely the large operators that are going to be the largest focus of compliance. In terms of like, I want to do this, you're not allowing me to do this, but Apple, I'm going to make sure that the DMA comes down on you hard. But on the other hand, the EU can say that, yeah, I don't care that it's just these small developers that are getting hosed. You are in violation, and therefore, get your checkbook out again. We're going to need another $500 million.
Well, and as someone who's statistically a small developer, and I've been developing software for 20 years that I've released on the Mac, on iOS, on iPadOS, and have been, you know, in and out of ecosystems to do this, and I'm getting ready to release another app soon that I actually might sell, because usually I make them for other people. What I will say is that we can talk about the little person being run over. And if you are doing something like an emulator, you're an exception to that process. But I can tell you, as a small developer, there is nothing like the App Store. This is why everyone wants to be there. It has never been better. I had to manage my own copyright protection, and I had to manage my own, you know, who's buying it and where it's going. We calculated for my green screen software that we didn't know what it was, but the piracy was somewhere between 10 times the number of sales to 100 times the number of sales that were going out there, and us going after that was impossible, and all that went away. And people can just download it, and I don't have to deal with it. And the level of convenience for a small developer, you know, I know someone that was interested in doing, you know, they were interested in knots, and for a long time they wrote a little app, and they made $50,000 a month, you know, selling it, you know. So the thing is that and I can tell you that these things have been a lot harder. So the opportunity for a small developer who has a good idea to make money has never been better than what we're doing. So we can talk about these exceptions, but we have to kind of take into account remember that 86% of the developers out there don't pay anything to Apple, whether it's free or it's some kind of other thing. They're not paying any back end to Apple. You know, the other 12% are paying, you know, are paying 15%, not 30%, which is what the advertised rate by Spotify is. And there's 2%, you know, which are the Spotify's, the Epics, the, you know, those ones that are paying this 30% amount. And a lot of them are readers, which then aren't paying that after the first year. So a lot of times it's, you know, and again, for the user, it's really, you know, it's a pretty good deal, you know, like, you know, to be able to have the security and the convenience of what we have. And again, the chaos that will most likely occur after this will not be something that the users will appreciate. You know, as we start to have all these side loads and things. And again, we, of course, have the ability to stay inside of our thing. But as soon as you have companies like Netflix or someone else side loaded only, you know, like saying, well, we're only going to go on the outside. Mm-hmm. That's taking something away from the user that they had before. And, you know, that's the problem. That's the problem. That, and I'm excited that the EU is doing this, and I'm excited that it's in the EU, because if they prove that it's going to work, then it's going to work. If they prove that they're wrong, they get to prove it. And as an American, I don't have to.
And you don't have to deal with it. I think the truth is, you mentioned Netflix.
From the outside.
I think the truth is, and this is something you mentioned last week that really resonated with me, which is anybody going to use this? And I think that that is the big question, is like, I know that there will be some companies that want to push this, and there are going to be some things like Epic with Fortnite, right? Where they feel very strongly about this, and they have a user base that might be motivated to go outside the App Store in order to download Fortnite, whether it's in a marketplace or it's just sideloaded, because that's a thing that's going to happen now. That is, there's going to be some of that, but I do wonder in the long run that when we're going to talk about all these different ways, and it's going to end up being a teeny, 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 tiny fraction of the actual experience, because most people don't want to bother. And like, yeah, if you're somebody who wants to use an emulator on an iPhone, which again is teeny, 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 tiny, because this doesn't cover the Mac. It doesn't, I mean, the Mac's open. It doesn't cover the iPad. The iPad is closed and not affected by the DMA. So it's the small fraction. Yeah, okay. But the regular people, I am dubious to the idea that any major developer is going to say, well, in the EU, you have to go through this dance to get our app, because they want you to get their app. That's the number one thing they want to do, is they want you to use your app. And the App Store is really, really good at that. So this is a tempest in a teapot, potentially.
And Epic had the problem with, even with the sideload for Epic, no one did it. Like you know, like Fortnite mattered, but not that much.
Even in the Google Play Store, it's true.
Well, it's still, as I will never tire of saying, it's still a good thing, because the reason why those small developers no longer have to pay a 30% fee was because for the first time, Apple was getting a lot of pressure from the outside to change the way they run the App Store.
Totally.
And secondly, even if it is a small number of people who take advantage of this, a small amount of users and a small number of developers that take advantage of sideloading, I'm okay with the idea that so long that if they feel as though this is the best solution for them, at least it's possible. It's not, Apple's made a lot of work into this to make sure that's not necessarily going to be advantageous, but at least it's possible. I mean, despite how wonderful, and I don't mean that sarcastically, despite how wonderful the Mac App Store is, there are still lots and lots of different places where you can buy really great commercial apps outside the App Store where they just don't want to be part of that, or they don't want to have to deal with
like.
But again, they have that choice, and if they want to take the risks, they can take the risks.
And to your point, like an app I use probably almost every day is an app called Downy, and you definitely can't get that on the App Store.
that's tricky. That's problematic.
I use that too, and I would even say that there's a fair use aspect of that, but it doesn't matter, right? It's like that.
Well,
there are going to be those cases, and this is the funny thing, right? Is the Mac has survived and thrived, and you can install anything you want on it, and Apple doesn't want to go down that route for some good reasons, but I think in the end, these other devices, like everybody's been trained to do it this way, and they're going to keep doing it this way, and that's just how it is.
I softened on my stance just a little bit. I think Andy will be proud of me, because I softened on my stance a little bit on this. And it happened this morning. I was going to show spatial video on the, how 180 video works. And so I was going to show it, and I was going to do a screen capture from my headset. So I'm going to put the Vision Pro on and then send it to the Apple TV, so that I could show people on the show that it was, you know, how it works and what it looks like and everything else. And everything, including Apple's own stuff, blacks out immediately.
All locked down. Right.
I was like, really? Really? Like, it is a screen capture of me watching a video. Like, it's not a good video version of this. And you're really going to copy that? And I was, and you're really going to black that out? And so then I was like, oh, okay. All right.
It's the worst.
Yeah.
DRM makes allies of us all.
That doesn't do that.
Yeah, what? No, I think we're kind of grappling with an unwinding of the original vision of the App Store as part of the problem that we have here. Because in the EU, what's happening is we're pulling apart free apps from paid apps in some ways with the technology fee. And anytime you do that, you suddenly realize that while this bundle of things, whether there are paid apps and free apps all together in the App Store originally, made sense both for developers, users, and Apple for different reasons. But when you start pulling them apart, those values are different for each of those constituents. And as a result, that's where you get this friction, where now why am I paying a core technology fee if I'm doing a free app? You know, that sentiment didn't have to exist when everything was bundled together and some things were, you know, subsidizing other things, I think.
Well, but I think the other question is also, and this would be the case for 99.99% of the apps that go out, is why would you go outside the App Store if you're giving something away? Like, if you're doing an emulator, it makes sense. But otherwise, I mean, I've developed quite a few free apps that are, you know, other companies use. And it's pretty awesome. Like, you just don't have to think about it. And it just goes out and you're not paying for the servers. You're not figuring out where it came from. You're not you want to run an update. Oh my goodness.
I mean, some developers would prefer to sell their own software like they do on the Mac, on the web, and have their customer list be their customer list and be able to maintain it. But others will trade that off for being in an App Store environment because it's so much easier and it's just a choice. And I guess that comes back to the choice thing. But as John pointed out, I think the real question is this about that? Is this about small to mid-sized developers?
Yeah.
And is it about the user, which is the other thing that we've touched on here? Or is it really about tech giants trying to keep the money for themselves and other tech giants saying, no, we want that money. Not to be too cynical, but
it's really an aristocratic argument here. Like it's a bunch of rich companies who want more money from another rich company. And that rich, you know, this is Henry V versus the French, you know, the French king, you know, like it's not, you know, who's going to put bread on someone's table in Edinburgh, you know.
That is a fantastic segue, Alex. because we're going to take a break and talk about more stuff. But once more, onto the breach, Leo, with a word from our sponsor.
I want to interrupt just one more time. I know I'm on vacation, but this is important. I really need to tell you about this. While we're on vacation, Lisa was very worried that the same thing that's been happening lately would happen while we're on vacation, which is our employees would get an emergency text from her. Not really from her, but looks like it's from her, saying, quick, buy some Amazon gift cards and send it to me. Now, fortunately, our employees are well-trained, but it always raises our hackles that, well, first of all, how do they know about Lisa and who our employees are? Where do they get this information? Folks, there are data brokers out there, hundreds of them, collating this information, and it's a big security risk for your business, for your family, for your home, for you. If you've ever searched your name online, I don't recommend it, but you will be blown away by the amount of personal information that's there for a Google search. That's why you need Delete Me. Delete Me helps reduce risk from identity theft, from credit card fraud, from robocalls, cybersecurity threats, harassment, unwanted communications overall. We immediately, when this happened first time a couple of years ago, signed Lisa up for Delete Me. All your executives, all your managers should be using Delete Me, because that way that personal information is kept off the public internet. That slows hackers down. Now, it all starts by signing up. You got to do this and submit some basic personal information. Now, I know maybe that's a little scary, but first of all, you could trust these guys. They're fantastic. And they need that information to know what to look for, right? Not a lot, but just enough to know how to find records about you. Then Delete Me's experts. And by the way, human people, real people, not AI. These are real people who are really skilled. Well, they'll go out and they'll find and remove your personal information from hundreds of data brokers. And of course, there's more every day, and they know who all of them are. They'll reduce your online footprint. They'll keep you and your family safe. But it doesn't end there, because they're like cockroaches. These data brokers keep coming back. They keep repopulating this information. So Delete Me will keep scanning and removing your personal information regularly. You'll get regular reports. They'll get this stuff off, including addresses, photos, emails, relatives, phone numbers, social media, your property value, and more. And since privacy exposures and incidents can affect individuals differently, you'll definitely want to talk to Delete Me's privacy advisors. They can help you understand what's going on, what you have to watch out for, what they're doing, and keep you up to date on what they're doing at all times so that you got the support you need when you need it. Protect yourself, reclaim your privacy, get this stuff offline. Go to joindeleteme.com/twit and use the code TWIT. You'll get a good deal, 20% off. Joindeleteme.com/twit. The offer code is TWIT. Get your personal data back. Get it off the internet. Delete me. Join deleteme.com/tweet. We use it. We've been using it for years now. All right. Back to the grindstone, Jason Snell. Take this show home, will you?
A grindstone. That's terrifying. A grindstone. Back to the grindstone.
Now, are we making flour or shiny rocks? You tell us, listeners, in the chat room. The
grindstone. Yikes, yikes, yikes. All right. Well, leaving the grindstone aside, instead, we're going to, I call to order this week's meeting of the MacBook Air Heritage Club, which we founded last week. We're going to be discussing issues of interest about Apple's most popular Mac, the MacBook Air, as it should be. And it is in the first, we'll start with some old business. Oldest business we can think of is the M1 MacBook Air, which we reported last week had been removed from Apple's website and was no longer being sold. Does that mean it was discontinued? The answer may surprise you in that it turns out, as a press release on Walmart's website of all places, I have never visited corporate.walmart.com before, but I did last week, announced that the MacBook Air M1 is now available for $699 at walmart.com. It's also available, I saw it at bestbuy.com for $650. It's being put available in some other places as well. This is the first Mac ever to be sold at Walmart, is my understanding. And it's the M1 Air, which is gone but not forgotten and actually not gone. John, what's your read on this? What do you think about this one?
I think it's really interesting. I think one of the more interesting things, too, is that these Macs are actually more expensive on the refurb store now, which is kind of remarkable. Because I looked a few days ago, and they were $756 for the same model. And I'm glad to see it, because the M1 MacBook Air is still a fantastic computer. I have one. I haven't really felt the need to upgrade it yet. I'm kind of getting there, but on the other hand, it's still plugging away and doing a great job. So it's nice that we're at a price point now where it's more affordable to a greater number of people.
And I have a MacBook Pro from 2020 that is like a 14-inch or 13-inch or whatever that number is back then. And it's an Intel. It's the last one before it. And that's still what I go out in. I mean, I don't go out very often. But when I travel, that's the laptop I use. And I'm jumping on Zoom and I can open up the odd Photoshop thing and everything else. And so I think that the Mac Air M1 is going to be considerably faster than that. And it's $699. What a great deal. For just doing basic, basic Photoshop stuff, some basic video editing, I'm sure we'll do fine. Yeah. And then a bunch of email and a bunch of, surfing the web and having something that can just, put things together for that price. It's pretty awesome.
I should say there's a clarification of something that in the Discord, then I'll get to you, Andy, in a second, is Knox Harrington asked, are they still manufacturing the M1 Air, or is this a clearance sale? My understanding, and John Gruber said this, and I think that he's got some good sources, his understanding is that they're still making it. They're still making it. They're still selling it in various channels. What they've done is said, if you come to apple.com and you're buying a laptop, we're not going to show you our $699 laptop. But if you're at Walmart, yeah, you can buy it. And so I think they're still making them. It's cheap for them. As we learned, this is one of those interesting things about how this works. The longer something is on the press, is on the factory, the cheaper it is. Like, Apple starts making it not at a loss, but at smaller margins. And then over time, the margins get bigger and bigger and bigger, which allows them to do the thing where the M2 Air that used to cost $1,399 now costs $999, right? Well, imagine how much cheaper the M1 Air must be, and you can keep that line going, and it allows Apple to reach a price point that I'm sure Tim Cook likes a lot, where they can sell a $699 Air and still make a good margin on it and reach markets that might not have bought a MacBook at all before. Andy, go ahead.
I think that's right on point, where there are people who are shopping at Walmart for laptops that are not going to Apple stores for laptops, not going to other retail channels that Apple has already had a lot of success with. So in addition to being able to do the math and realize that, okay, we can actually make money on these M1 Airs at $700, there's also, we are going to reach people we weren't reaching before. Certainly not the low end consumers, but the people who maybe came in expecting to spend $450 for a kind of decent Windows laptop for their kids for school think that, wow, like for like just $150 more, I can get them like a really, really nice Mac. Sign me up. And this really has been like one of my dreams for the Mac line for Apple for a long time. The idea of having a sub $700 MacBook out there. I absolutely appreciate that there are things that Apple has a great even technical difficulty doing, which is making items of their design, items that uphold the logo very, very well, that nonetheless are mid-range price. And so it's really wonderful. I mean, it took me back to my first MacBook, my first PowerBook was when they discontinued the PowerBook 100, like the first trio of PowerBooks. And they clearanced them out at Costco. And I did one of the dumbest, most dangerous things I have ever done in my life. Fortunately, I was a teenager when I did it, which is I had to be at work at 9 a.m. the next morning. I didn't want them to sell out. So I drove about an hour and 20 minutes to the closest Costco on like no sleep, bought it, drove an hour and 20 minutes back with even less sleep than I did when I started off with, and then wound up having to nap under my desk for the rest of the morning. But yeah, it was worth it.
Yeah, this is like, I mean, again, a lot of people who listen to and talk on podcasts like this, you know, we're focused on much higher end kind of models. But yeah, this to me speaks to absolutely, especially since, okay, Walmart puts out a press release. Right. It's going to only be in some select stores, but it's also on Walmart.com. Walmart has actually got if you haven't thought about it this way, it's actually one of the most forward-thinking retailers in terms of going from being in a big box to also being online. They have a whole setup in the Bay Area where they've hired a lot of people away from other e-commerce companies, and they've done some very clever things. But they are going to put it in some stores. I think this is an interesting test in some ways, but they're going to reach people who, as Andy said, have not even considered buying a Mac before. With a product, Apple is in this unique position with Apple Silicon, where the M1 Air, even though it's old now, is still great. It's still great. It's still more than most people need. And making it available sub $700 is a really, it's a great story for people who might have always wanted to buy a Mac, but haven't had the chance, or they've had a hand-me-down Mac or a used Mac, and they could actually get access to this. It'll be interesting to see how it goes for Walmart. And I do expect that it may show up in other places as well. This might also be a Costco kind of thing. We'll see. I don't know what the nature of the relationship with Walmart is. My understanding is also in the education channel, these are still available as well, that there are people in the education, even though it's an invisible product now on Apple's website, that if you want to buy 5 or 10 or 20 of them in the education channel, my understanding is you can do that too. So it's alive with an asterisk, but I love it. I love the move for them.
The education channel, I think, is still the only place you can get a MacBook Air with 128 gigs of storage.
Oh boy. Maybe don't get that one.
That's saucy. That's,
yeah. Maybe take a pass on that one.
Speaking of MacBook Air Heritage Club, I thought I would throw in some other MacBook Air news here. In the discussion about the lid closed mode on the MacBook Air M3, including here last week, one of the questions was, if you run it lid closed, does it thermal throttle sooner? The idea there is this is a fanless laptop. It's engineered to run, you know, you can run a lid closed. That's not new. It's just with two monitors now that you have to run it lid closed. And running it lid closed, presumably, insulates the hot part a little bit more by putting the screen on top of the keyboard and maybe obscuring the vents a little bit so that there's a little less airflow. And so it can't radiate heat as well passively, which is all that the Air can do. And the question was, how does it run on lid closed with two monitors? And my experience in just using it like I do every day was fine, but full credit to the people there's a Tech Radar report. I don't know if they're the ones who did it or not, but somebody out there in the internet, bless the internet, they're like, oh, what if I really brutalize it with, it was Max Tech on YouTube.
Yeah, Max Tech.
What it is, Max Tech on YouTube. And they're like, what if I run a high test 3D benchmark on it? They ran 3D Mark Wildlife Extreme stress test for about 20 minutes. What is the difference between running lid closed and lid open? And the answer is there's an appreciable difference, because when you run lid open, it doesn't have to throttle as much because it's now because it's able to radiate more of that heat. Now, what I would say is, again, at this level of performance, perhaps don't buy a MacBook Air, or perhaps don't attach it to two monitors. But it is a great data point, and I'm glad they did it, because this is, you're seeing the difference. Literally, it's the difference in heat being radiated out of the MacBook Air and the M3, whether the lid is closed or not. That's the only change, because there's no fan. That is just insulation based on the lid being in the way happening there.
Yeah. Wouldn't it be nice if there were some sort of third-party tool, or even a system-level tool, where you could just say, yeah, I know that the screen is open, but could you just switch it off so I could use two screens? Because it's not just the extra ventilation.
Right.
If I'm not being mindful, I could keep it docked that way. And I didn't buy this MacBook Air to do a whole bunch of 4K transcoding and modeling. However, I just got into this JAG, and then I'd start to wonder 5 days, oh my God, I've had this source of heat underneath like this screen. Have I damaged the display in any way by basically roasting it above this keyboard?
I would also say, wouldn't it be convenient if you're in that two display configuration to use the keyboard and trackpad that Apple gives you with the display turned off? And it is like the next frontier for us arguing about lid closed, lid open. Is it's always been a little frustrating. I was just somebody in Discord that I'm in was asking about running a MacBook lid closed, but on as a server. And I said, well, you got to get one of those dongles that emulates a display. And somebody was like, well, no, you don't have to do that on my Mac Mini. I don't do that. And I'm like, yeah, but here's the difference. Apple makes a very specific judgment when the lid gets closed on a laptop that the jig is up, unless you've got an external display attached. And so wouldn't it be nice if you could just use the keyboard and the trackpad while the two screens were on? And it's just not something that they've done, or to leave it open just for ventilation, right? Like, but you can't. Too bad, but thank you to Max Tech for trying it out, and now we know. And again, if you really care about ventilation and running your computer hot, MacBook Air might not be the best choice for you, even though this is the MacBook Air Heritage Club with a long history of bad performance when things get hot. Let me tell you, I have the original MacBook Air where in the late afternoon with my west facing windows, one of the cores would just shut down. So
still have the burn mark on the inside of my heel where I was sitting cross-legged and had it on my lap.
Why is that cursor so jerky? Oh, it's because I don't work in a meat locker.
Yes.
And therefore, that's okay. The other MacBook Air story here is a wild story from Tom's Hardware. I don't know which one of you put this in the show notes. It was probably Andy, but I don't know.
It was me.
I love this one.
I thought it was a lovely bookend for the other story.
So what if we put a heat sink on the outside of the MacBook Air, making contact with it, and we pull the heat out of the MacBook Air, then how does it run? And the answer is, it runs way better because now it's got a cooling system.
Yeah. Big hunk of metal. Really works well with fins.
Turns out.
And it looks, I don't know, does it look Babylon 5 meets Blade Runner? I like the look.
It's
kind of
cool.
It
does
look
nice.
Yeah, it looks nice.
And the question is what happens if you put a fan on that, on those fins? Mm-hmm. We actually... Blackmagic's old original switchers used to have these fins on the back of them, and they were just kind of opened. And what was nice is they were quiet. But then what we did with them is we figured out a way, because they would overheat, and we put a big like a little fan that's silent, you know, that you can buy for computer installations on the end of that fins, and pulling the air through it, and it dramatically changes the heat signature. So there's all kinds of places we can go with this now.
And this was Max Tech as well, actually. So I should congratulations to Max Tech for creating a story that created a problem and then creating a story that creates the solution. I love it. But this is hilarious. I mean, passive cooling, active cooling, the difference. MacBook Air is a fanless laptop. It's all physics, and yet it's actually amazing to see it in action and say, like, this is bad, and then this little dock thingy is good because it's radiating away. It's a heat. Yeah. It's going to slow down if it gets too hot because the chip doesn't want to melt itself, right? So this is what you get.
External heat sink, then we put a fan on it, then we water cool it. That next step is just RGB everywhere, and now we're just running Windows.
Again, work in a meat locker.
Drill some holes in it, right? You know, I mean, you got to create your own ventilation.
Literal speed holes. Excellent.
Yeah, I love it. That's what we need. That's what we need in our lives. Howard Oakley over at Eclectic Light Company, which is my favorite blog that connects Apple technology and a classic painting.
Yep.
I'm not kidding.
No, it's true.
It's amazing. I have learned a lot about classical painting from Howard Oakley. Eclectic Light Company, pointing out one of these areas that his quirky, he's got a very specific set of focuses on macOS, and I find them fascinating because very few other people have those focuses. And he's discovered a very serious bug in Sonoma 14.4 that is worth warning people about. If you rely on the versioning system that's built into macOS, and if you don't know about it, it may save your bacon, by the way. I had this happen just the other day where I'm like, oh, I don't have a Time Machine backup. And then I thought, wait a second. There are versions, right? Somewhere right. on my Mac, there are versions of this file from the past. And there are, which is pretty awesome if you're using an app that supports it. However, what Oakley found was if you're running 14.4 and your documents are in iCloud Drive and you have optimized Mac storage turned on, which is the setting that means that your cloud stuff is not necessarily going to stay on your device. It may be removed from the physical drive because it's accessible from the cloud, which is usually a very helpful feature. But in 14.4, if you put those things together, you risk having all of your versions evicted when your file is evicted. And then when it comes back, the versions don't come back, which is not great. It's a very niche thing, but like it's worth warning people about.
Yeah.
And it, for a great feature. And this is like, you get your Mac set up exactly as Apple wants you to set it up use this feature. And then now it suddenly is broken, which is too bad.
He appropriately has filed it as a bug as of yesterday, because that's clearly not an intended operation of that feature. Again, it shows you how long that release has been out before, and no one has had a big furore about, oh my god, I just lost all my versions. But nonetheless, it's not what that feature was designed to perform like. So
so be warned. And hey, did you know that there's a versioning feature built into Mac OS?
It's been
there a while now.
I forget about it sometimes, but it is good. I mean, when the apps that support it, unfortunately, I don't think that many apps really do support it.
It's true. Yeah. It's true. I retrieved some stuff out of a numbers spreadsheet the other week, and that was how I did it, because I realized I didn't have a proper backup of it somewhere that had the data, but I was able to walk through a large list of versions in numbers.
It terrifies me. I'm constantly like, I will save my own versions. I mean, generally when I'm working on stuff, I just put a date on the day that I worked on it, and then a dash 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and I'm just constantly afraid of it. But I come from I'm used to building models that have 130 versions.
This was a case where I have a clone that runs at 2 a.m. and I had a completely catastrophic lockup on my system the next morning.
The
file was from 4 p.m. and so it wasn't there. And then I ended up trying to find it in the cloud and all sorts of other things. But yes, everybody should back up their stuff. You should totally do it. Here is a story that I saw that I thought was really interesting. It's a blog post from Alexander Vasic. It is about the state of the Hackintosh community. Now, you may have expected this. I think we all expected this. But the Hackintosh was a bright and shining era where you could take an Intel PC with certain cards, certain chips, and install Mac OS on it, because Mac OS ran on Intel, and it still runs on Intel. But as this blog post details, Apple is in the process of removing a lot of the older stuff in Sonoma for systems that they haven't shipped and are no longer compatible, which makes sense, right? It makes perfect sense from 2012, 2013. But the end result is, if you are somebody who is still maintaining a Hackintosh running on an Intel PC hardware, first off, Sonoma is probably not for you. Ventura is probably a better bet for you. And as he pointed out, really, it was a good run, but it's now over, because Apple is focused on Apple Silicon and they're not focused on maintaining compatibility with the older hardware that was used to get this stuff to work. And I just thought it was a really good level-headed response, which was, this is really great. Yeah. It was a good time. I can't complain. It came, the Hackintosh, rise of the Hackintosh happened at a bad point for Apple hardware. And he said, now with Apple Silicon, it's actually a really good point for Apple hardware. And nobody's going to take that functional Hackintosh away from you. But in terms of new progress. Like, I just liked it because it was like, well, I'm calling it. Like, basically, it's over because the jig is up because the Apple Silicon era is here. And that don't blame Apple for this. They're not trying to stomp on the last remaining Hackintoshes. It really is just Apple continues to evolve their platform, and they're focused on Apple Silicon now.
Yeah. It was a really bad. I'm sorry. Go ahead, John.
No, I was going to say, in particular, I think it was Bluetooth and Wi-Fi cards that aren't compatible anymore. Yeah. That Apple's really moved on with those internals. And yeah, I think it's kind of sad because I think that kind of hardware modding is a lot of fun and fun, cool project. But yeah, I mean, we are in a much better place with the Mac now today with Apple Silicon.
Yeah, I mean, remember when we had the oatmeal box Mac Pro as the top of the poppermost of the Mac line, and basically was just no good for what any like high energy Mac user wanted. Like, consistently, the fastest Mac the benchmark were always like Hackintoshes. Like, okay, I can build a Mac out of Windows components that's going to be much, much better for just. Period than anything that Apple's going to be doing. If all I'm looking for is performance, and there was like a wonderful time. This is one of the most fun like Mac experiences I have ever had. This is my Dell Inspiron Mini 9 from like 2008, 2009, a 9-inch. Like it's not a netbook. It's kind of like there's Dell's version of like the same build quality as their normal laptops in 2008, but in a 9-inch form factor. And I got, I think it was 10.2 or 10.3, whatever it was in 2008, 2009 running on it. And of course, this was like pre-iPad. This is pre-everything. And the ability to have this tiny, tiny thing running all of my Mac apps on it was so cool. It was burning up like message boards, because as you point out, John, very, very correctly, that like the big deal was, okay, are you using the right, does the hardware that you of the laptop you're using use a Wi-Fi chip for which there are open source drivers? Because otherwise, this is like the first one where like everything in one package was like the trackpad would work, the audio would work, you could hook up external USB devices, that would work, everything worked great. It was just and the entire user interface just simply, I see for some reason you have a screen with much less real estate than anything else that's in the Mac lineup. I don't care because I haven't been screened against that sort of stuff. So yeah, there was a time when this was a fun thing to do. There was a time when if you were a power user, it was a necessary thing to do. Now it's just basically, hey, look, I can get Mac OS running on this Nintendo dual screen Game Boy. So yeah, it's an end of an era, to be sure.
Fun era. I know, and people are like cranky. Like, oh, we did this at Macworld. We built. I think we called it the Franken Mac is what we chose to call it. And really, in the end, it sort of called out like not only all the nice things that Apple does that for in its OS that were broken in the systems that we use, sure. But also the fact that we were able to make a very, very powerful mid-range tower, a system that Apple never really, you know, they stopped making it. And it was way cheaper than the Macs at the time. But again, the Apple Silicon era has really transformed the Mac and made it much better and changed the equation. Even if you're down at a, you know, like a Mac Mini, even you're in pretty good shape. So we are going to do our picks of the week and wrap up the show. And that's all going to happen after one last visit from past Leo. Past Leo.
Thank you, Jason. Hold on just a sec. We got one more thing to talk about, and that is, boy, you know it. Everybody knows it. We love it. We use it. Ecamm, the leading live streaming and video production studio built for Mac. I'll tell you what. If I had had Ecamm almost 20 years ago when we started Mac Break Weekly, I would have been using that. I would have saved so much money. Whether you're a beginner or an expert, Ecamm is here to elevate your video production. This is the state of the art. Things have really come a long way from streaming and recording to podcasting to presenting. It's Ecamm Live. It's your all-in-one video tool, perfect for simplifying your workflow. It could do so much. Ecamm, E-C-A-M-M. Ecamm Live includes support for multiple cameras, screen sharing, you get a live camera switcher so you can direct your show in real time. This is what Rosemary and Micah use to do iOS today. Frankly, whenever I need to do a more elaborate call from home, I use Ecamm. The other day when we were finishing Twit, I went home, fired up Ecamm. You'll stand out from the crowd with high-quality video. You can add logos, titles, lower thirds, graphics. You can share your screen. You can drop in video clips. You can bring on interview guests, use a green screen, and so much more. Join the thousands of worldwide entrepreneurs, marketing professionals, podcasters, educators, musicians, and other Mac users who rely on Ecamm Live every single day, including many of the people you see on our shows. Get 1 month free when you subscribe to any of Ecamm's plans. Go to ecamm.com/twit. Use the promo code TWIT at checkout. E-C-A-M-M, ecamm.com/twit. Don't forget that promo code TWIT at checkout. And now back to Mac Break Weekly.
Thank you, ghost of Leo Laporte, wherever you are on vacation. It's time for the picks of the week, where we get, I love this part because it's our tradition now to talk about things that you could download and use. And I think we're going to start with our guest, John Voorhees. Do you have a pick for us?
I do have a pick. I'm going to pick an app called Chroniclane. Chroniclane is a fantastic app that you can use on the iPhone, the iPad, the Mac, even on Vision OS. It's got a native Vision OS app, and it's a little bit like a habit tracker, but it's not just for tracking habits. It's really for tracking anything you want at all. And it's got a real emphasis on visual presentation. It takes data and presents it in all sorts of ways. So you could say, take the reminders in the reminders app that you've finished and create a heat map with them, for instance, to get an idea of what days you're most active on. It has a great set of widgets, and it's got super deep shortcut support, which makes it really easy to get that data out of those other apps and into Chroniclane, where you can manipulate it and create all sorts of neat charts. So Chroniclane's my pick.
Wow. Thank you. Very nice. And if you would like to know more about awesome apps, this is what I do, is you go to macstories.net, where John and Federico and the gang are writing about all sorts of different apps that are
indeed
awesome. It's a great source. It's sort of like a pick of the week all the time on a website. That's what,
all 7 right. days a week.
I can't, you keep the site on 7
yeah,
days a week?
Yeah, we don't. We never 24? Shut it off for some reason. 24/7.
Amazing.
It's like a flick, a fluorescent light fixture. It costs less money to keep it on than to simply turn it off and on all the time.
Imagine the idea that a website would like shut down overnight and like put up a test pattern. That's hilarious. I love that idea. There's an April 1st idea. Just put up a test pattern. If local time, yeah, and play the national anthem. All right, things are about to get weird.
Yeah, something's happening over there.
And it's because Alex Lindsay is up next. Here we go.
He's okay, in a Sea Hunt cosplay.
Go to Andy first.
Oh, no, okay. Wave it off. Andy, your pick first.
my pick is a menu bar-based reminders app that reminds me exactly how much I love like the Mac developer community, because every time, oh my God, they come up with such great ideas. Another thing will let you set a timer and then remind you of something. Okay, number one, the interface for this. It's a dingbat inside the menu bar. You click on it and you drag down, and the length of the line that you drag down is the amount of time you want to wait before the reminder. And of course, there's also an indicator as you drag that shows you exactly how much time you're adding. Okay, then you either let go and it'll just simply, 18 minutes, great, I'll remind you in 18 minutes. Or you can also, if you want to, type in, here's what the reminder is above, and you can have more than one like reminder set this way, and there will be little pieces of Pez with the time and the name of the label of the reminder in your menu bar. And as if that's not enough, it does sync with Apple Reminders. So the fact that you set a reminder from your desktop by doing this little rubber band thing remind me to pick up somebody at like 10:28 in the evening, you will get a reminder on your Apple Watch later that night that this is what you're supposed to do. It's $6.99. I think there's a trial period for it. Again, I love this site. Simple ideas executed flawlessly, and it's such a beautiful interface that this is. It took an iOS developer to get the idea you scroll all the way down and then you spring it back, and that means you want me to refresh this display. This is also the sort of reminder interface that only a Mac developer would come up with. I love it.
Very nice, very nice. Okay, Alex, are you ready?
I'm as ready as ever I'm ever going to be.
By this time, my lungs were aching for air.
I was trying to show something with audio, but I think I'm sharing the audio to my switcher, which isn't going anywhere, and I can't hear it myself. So anyway, I'm going to just show it here. So if you see, if you look at what I'm looking at here, this will be not as good as if I had had let's see, can you see it there? So this is called Spatial Symphony, and I downloaded it almost immediately. Close there. And what you can do is it's basically a synthesizer, but you're using your hands. So this hand over here, one hand is the my left hand is my volume, my right hand is controlling the tones. And so what you do is you can sit here and play with, you know, and it just is such an interesting application as far as like thinking about, you know, obviously there's what you would obviously immediately think of is with the theremin, right? So you have a theremin sound that you can do here, and you can, you know, kind of affect it here, you know, like in that process. And so you have this basically virtual theremin, but you have, you know, you have the ray gun, which is, you know, a little bit harder. The nebula is really nice to hear when I get the sharing working, but I don't have the sharing working. But it's really nice there. And then there are pro ones. I got the pro ones. So there's lots of, so there's a free version of it that has the basic stuff. And then I bought the pro one. I can't remember how much it was. It wasn't very much. But you can sit here and just play with it. You can see all these colors. These are telling you what you're doing. And I found myself losing a lot of time last night playing with this where I'm, you know, sitting there, because what happens is you're like any other instrument, you're learning how your hands affect the sound. And so as you start to move it, and I guess it's not as nearly as good without me figuring out how to share audio, which will be my new problem as I start to do these recommendations. But it's a really powerful, just a really cool app. And again, I think what it does is it really points to what's coming, you know, that it's not going to just be, you know, like I think right now we're still thinking a lot about, how do we recreate the real world inside the virtual? But there's this point where we start building things that you just can't do in the real world, you know, and the interfaces and how we interact and instruments and all kinds of other things are going to start moving past that, you know, and we're going to start just interacting. But the idea that I could have a theremin-like, you know, control over something and be able to start creating, I'm not good enough, like any other instrument that you spent the first hour on, there's nothing out there that I would share with anyone. but I can see how, you know, you could start to figure out where, you know, where your hand has to be to get the notes that you're looking for and all the, you know, all the things that you might play there. And I think it's going to be fascinating, you know, as we start to see more and more of that.
It looks like a lathe for sound, though, when we're looking at the live screen.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an incredible, like the fact that at first I was like, I don't understand why they put those shapes in there, you know, the squares. I don't know if it'll pop right back up. If I put it back on, let's see here. So when I did this before, let me see if it.
Alex is tapping on nothing in the air.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So when I
killing fleas,
when I started doing this here,
brushing your head.
So the, you know, when you start doing this, you're like, I don't understand why those were even there, but it's super important to understand where you are as you're moving these and what you're affecting. So the rectangles here, the visualization really makes a huge difference in understanding what you're doing. So you can see how I've opened it up a little bit. It's louder, quieter, you know, so I can understand what I'm doing with this. And that visual response is super important to understanding what, you know, what's actually happening. So it makes it easier for you to understand, you know, how you're affecting the sound. So it's slick.
Pretty cool.
You know, so that's my recommendation. But I think we're going to see more and more of these that are starting to move again, very quickly starting to move away from trying to, like, there's like the measure tool there's another one that I'm still playing with that I turned it on and suddenly it measured everything.
Oh,
like suddenly there was blocks everywhere. It just measured the whole everything I was in front of it. I was like, oh, this is going to change everything about doing walkthroughs or anything else. Like it's not totally accurate yet. Like it still needs a little work. But you're seeing that there are things that are going to happen inside these headsets that you're no longer going to be. At first, we do what we always do, which is make it look like what we already know. but we're going to start this is a one step moving away from trying to be like anything else.
Yeah. Feeling like you've got magic powers is one of the things that is great about being in Vision Pro, and the more the better. Speaking of magical things that are unlike anything you've ever seen before, I'm going to make a pick. And my pick is, so imagine if we took the places we lived and you cut a hole in them so that you could look outside. We might call it something like, it's kind of like a computer window. Why don't we call it a window? Because it's kind of like a window on a computer, but it's actually like in your house.
Only the document is the sky.
Yeah, wow. Right. Well, guess what? There's an app for that. It's called It's called Windora for Vision Pro. And it is brilliant at what this little thing is. It's free. And then there's in-app purchase for other features. It takes your panoramas from your photo library and places them inside windows that you can place in your space. And the beauty of it is that it reacts exactly as if you were looking out a window in terms of the parallax effect as you move around. Now, the problem with Vision OS right now is persistence. You reboot or whatever and everything loses its place. But if you imagine a future OS release, perhaps Vision OS 2, where you can place objects in places in the world and then just leave them there, the idea that you could take a boring workspace and put an amazing panorama outside of it, not as just a picture on a wall, but as a window looking out on the space where, based on as you move your head, it actually will adjust as if it were really a window, including the window frame and everything. I was able to put a window on my on a wall with no windows in my house, and suddenly I was looking out, and it was Aoraki Mount Cook in New Zealand on the other side. Pretty incredible. So it uses the panoramas. And it's just, I mean, again, why is this necessary in life? It's not. It's just super cool application of this technology to dress up your surroundings while you're working in Vision Pro. And I think it's just a really clever idea. They even have ones that are shapes that are corner pieces, essentially, when you do the in-app purchase. There's one window in the free version where you can place it in the corner of a room, and it's like you've got two windows at right angles, and the same landscape is outside them, and they move as if, again, it's just the illusion can be pretty remarkable.
I still think that we're going to end up with, I find myself constantly wanting in my house an empty room that's like 15 by 15. Holodeck. Like a holodeck or
the belt.
Right. We're going to go dark on it. But the idea is just that I have an open space. I put my headset on. I got a place to sit or lie down or whatever. But for the most part, I even want those things just to fold into the wall or come out of the floor.
Sure.
And then I just want a space that I can just, but then I can imagine someone using what you're showing there.
You can dress it up.
You just dress up the whole thing and create this whole environment that when you walk in, you put the headset on. That's your office, and you keep on adjusting it and making it better and everything else.
Those are the things that I think are going to make it really, really wonderful. Like, again, virtual displays are lovely, but I want a calendar on the wall of my office that is not a real calendar, but it kind of looks like, not necessarily skeuomorphic, but every time I need to look at a project, it's right there, and it doesn't feel like I'm going through a window. Or even the next step, which is there's a shelf with a kitty on it. And when there's 10 minutes before, like I need to like leave the office, kitty like starts, stops napping and starts meowing and as if they want to be fed. And that's like my little alarm that, oh, kitty wants, it'll be the little distraction throughout the day of just looking at what kitty is doing, even though I have absolutely no interest in being responsible for a cat.
I love stuff like this. It's just, it's cool stuff. All right. We've reached the end. Let me thank my panelists for being here on Mac Break Weekly this week. John Voorhees, tell people where they can find you, and thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. You can find me. I'm at John Voorhees, really anywhere you can possibly look. Yes. And I'm also at MacStories.net, where I'm going to give a very small plug. We just moved a new podcast over to MacStories called Ruminate that I do with my good friend Rob Knight. At MacStories.net/Ruminate. It's all about the weird web.
Nice. Very nice. Highly recommend Ruminate and all of Mac Stories. Thanks for being here, John.
Thank you.
Andy and Iko, what do you have going on?
I am off NPR this week. Next week, go to WGBHnews.org on Thursday at 12:30. And you can listen to me talk about tech for live, or you can hear me later on because they will record it onto a magnetic strip of tape and then cue it up whenever you click the play button upon your demand. There might be some technology that I don't know about, but at minimum, there is an intern there with the reel-to-reel, making sure it's queued up to my stuff at all times.
It's good. It's good that they've got, I mean, the intern has to have something to do.
And, you know, college credits, man. You got to make it a valuable experience.
It's work experience. It's valuable work experience is what I always say.
They got to learn how to cut tape somewhere.
It's Alex Lindsay, where can people find you?
Well, every morning from 7 to 9 in the morning Pacific time, a bunch of us get together, a couple hundred of us get together, and we talk about tech issues. Today, we're talking about 180-degree video shooting and the things you have to think about and how you have to approach it as we get ready for things like the Meta releases and Apple releases. And so we talked about that. We had Clarissa Wright on, who's a PR specialist yesterday, which was fantastic. And tomorrow we're talking about live to podcast, kind of like what we do here. But the idea is like, what are the challenges of if you want to do a live show that has interaction with your audience and then turn it into a podcast? How do you do that? So we're going to be talking a little bit about that. Also on graymatter.show, Michael Krasny interviewed Andrew Fraknoy, who is an incredible astronomer. And I could listen to that guy forever. Like, you know, if you haven't listened to a Gray Matter Dodge show, this is a good one to get started. I could listen to him talk about space forever. Like, he's just the most pleasurable person to listen to. And he just has so much to say and he makes it so approachable. But, you know, we had Renee Ritchie a couple of weeks ago. You can see there's a lot of pretty useful people. Jason Snell, Andy and Notko are hidden in there. So a lot of great interviews there. But this last one was yet another one. So definitely check it out.
All right. Awesome. And you can find me at theincomparable.com, relay.fm, and of course, sixcolors.com with links to all my writing and podcasts and all the other things that I do, including MacBreak Weekly, where we will be back next week, and Leo will be back too. So I know you'll feel right at home with Leo being back in the chair, the big chair that I did not usurp today. So they've taken it to be cleaned. So it'll be nice and clean and ready for Leo when he comes back next week. But I have the sad duty to inform you that this has all been fun. And then we also got to talk about the MacBook Air Heritage Club, as we like to do. But you got to get back to work now. Break time is over. See you next time.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.